As people of God, our hope is in the fact that Jesus did all the good things for us. Our hope is in the fact that Jesus died on our behalf, that Jesus went through the waters of God's judgment for us. This evening, we're in Genesis chapter 7, verses 1 through 24. So that's the whole chapter, the entire chapter of Genesis chapter 7. We pick up here after the first six chapters, and the sixth chapter really culminating in the extreme wickedness of the earth. And God has promised that he will destroy all life on the earth, but he is going to preserve Noah. He's going to destroy all life on the earth through water, through a flood. So I have a question for you tonight. It'd be a little bit funny at first, but it's a serious question to think about. Here's my question for you. Will your boat float? Will your boat float? Everybody's got a boat. Everybody has a boat. Everybody has something, someone that they put their hope in. And they hope that they're going to stay above the water. They hope that they're going to stay alive. They hope that they're going to survive. They hope that in the end, when they reach that other shore, when they go into eternal life, that they hope that they will live forever in paradise. The question is, how do you get there? The question is, does your boat float? There's hardly very few things really that seem to be more terrifying than if you were to be, at least for me, I'm thinking this, if we were to go out into the ocean and we were going fishing and we were on a boat out there, and if you've ever gone fishing, say with Steve Thrower, and you go out to the short rigs, and I mean, you're not out there very far from the shore, just really a couple of miles or so, but when you're out there, you suddenly realize there's really not that many boats out here, and if this boat sunk, I do not have the stamina to swim to dry land. So if this boat goes down, I better not just enjoy the fishing. If this boat goes down, I better already have a plan to get somewhere safe. Can you think of something more terrifying than being on the Titanic and hitting that iceberg and you're having to try to figure out if your wife or your kids or however many people are actually going to get on the lifeboats? And you're having to decide whether or not you're going to have to stay back and try to brave the frigid water. You think of anything really more terrifying? There are a few things, baby, but that's pretty terrifying. You imagine most of us in here, we've been on boats and we've gone out into Sabine Lake. You've probably been on the Neches River in a boat. And when you're out there in the middle of the river going into the lake, man, that water's moving, isn't it? Especially when the tide is moving out. That water is just rushing, and you just get this sense, you get this feeling that if this boat were to capsize, somebody was to go in that water, the force of that water would just suck you out. And it's going to suck you away from being able to be helped. And whether we realize it or not, that water in the middle of the Sabine River, the middle of the Neches River, rather, where we're at, in the middle of the Neches River, it's about 60 foot deep in that channel. Nobody's going to touch their toes to the bottom and come back up. You're not going to have that much breath in your lungs. See, there's something about water as an agent of destruction. There's hardly anything on earth that's more forceful than water. Water can peel away rock. It'll just glide past it long enough, and it will shape and it will mold that rock without ever breaking out a single tool. Water is very unforgiving. Water doesn't suffer fools, nor is it sympathetic to careless people. You know that water never asks you, hey, are you being careful? You have access to a life jacket, a life preserver? No, we have to have Coast Guard and game wardens to tell us to do those things, because water doesn't suffer fools. It's not sympathetic to careless people. If you're going to approach water, What should you make sure of? You better make sure your boat floats. Because if it doesn't, you're dead. you're as good as dead. So pick up here in Genesis chapter 7 with that understanding here of the deadliness of water. And look at verses 1 through 10. Verses 1 through 10, you see the promise and the precision of God's judgment. The promise and the precision of God's judgment. I'll show you one truth from this first section, verses 1 through 10. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Go into the ark." Note how many times in these 24 verses that's said. "Go into the ark, you and all your household, for," circle that, "for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive." You don't get on that boat, you're going to die. If an animal doesn't get on the boat, they're going to die. "To keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days, very precise number there, right? "For in 7 days, I will send rain on the earth. Not for an indefinite amount of period, but a very definite period, a controlled period. For I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made, I will blot out from the face of the ground." Go ahead and get ready to underline this next sentence. "And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him." And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him. What you'll see multiple times, in fact, there's 4 times between Genesis 6:22 and the end of Genesis chapter 7 that a phrase similar to that is used to speak of Moses, or Noah rather. "And Noah did all that the Lord commanded." Noah did all that the Lord commanded. Look at the causal relationship here between the faithful obedience. When I say faithful, I mean Noah acted in obedience to God's commands because he believed God. So because of Noah's faithful obedience, that is the causal relationship. That is the reason why he was permitted to be saved, why he was permitted to enter into the ark. Look at it in verse 1. "The Lord said to Noah, 'Go into the ark, you and all your household. You get safety, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation.'" There is a causal relationship between our faithful response to God's commands and God's definite willingness to save us. There is a direct correlation, an inseparable line there. God rewards those who follow him faithfully. God takes care of those who obey him. God takes care of them, those whose lives are characterized by faith. In Genesis 6 and Genesis 7, you don't really see the word faith used, do you? But you would definitely use the word faithful to characterize Noah. Noah was a faithful man. In fact, the only faithful man in his generation. You don't see the word faith used, though, do you? But what do you see? You see that Noah did all that the Lord commanded. The Bible's understanding of faith is obedient action. It is obedient action. It's not just an acceptance of facts about God. If Noah had said, "Okay, God, I believe that you're going to send rain on the earth. I believe that you've given a good design for the ark. I believe you're going to destroy all living things. Oh, I believe that, Lord. And I'd call myself a follower of you. I believe that." Would that have been good enough to save him? No. What did Noah have to do? Get a hammer, get a saw, build a boat. You're going to have to construct something here. You're going to have to work through this, Noah. You're going to have to do all that was commanded. And if Noah didn't build the boat, there's no boat to get on. And there's no hope of hanging on to some driftwood because nobody else survives that way. So Noah has to obey. That's what it means to be full of faith. It means to be an obedient person. So all the animals, he's commanded to take on the boat there, and he does just that. Write down this first truth here about faith in action. Those who trust in God through faithful obedience are saved in the day of his wrath. Those who trust God through faithful obedience are saved in the day of his wrath. I want to give you a truth here that's going to really pull the whole text together, and I'll remind you of it here in the end. If you'll write down this leading truth for this entire text, because God is gracious to save the faithful, we must be obedient to all God commands. Because God is gracious. I include that for a reason. It says that Noah is a righteous man before God. It never says in the text that Noah was a perfect man. It never says that Noah was sinless. Noah was a righteous man. He strove to obey the Lord. He faithfully obeyed the Lord. It doesn't say that he was a perfect man. In fact, when he gets off of this ark, he's going to show you just how imperfect he really is. But Noah was a faithful man. Noah was a righteous man. And even when God saves a faithful, righteous person, does he do it because they earned it? No, because God is gracious. God is gracious. God didn't have to save Noah. God could have said, Noah, you're not perfect. You are not completely holy as I am holy. So Noah, you're done too. And I'm just going to start over with everything. No, he's gracious to save Noah. So because God is gracious to save the faithful, what must we do? Why are we given this text? We're able to read this text because Noah was faithful, but we're given this text so that we imitate his example. We're given this text so that we imitate it. We must be obedient to all God commands. It says, for in 7 days, very precise numbering here, in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. We'll come back to the precision of the language here towards the end, because I think that the precise language says something about God in this whole flood epidemic. It really, I'll tell you here, it says that God is sovereign over the whole process. God says it's going to start in 7 days. It does. It's going to rain 40 days and 40 nights, and it does. Everything happens just as he says it does. Can you imagine what it would be like if it were to rain for 40 days and 40 nights? We have a pretty good hint, don't we? Oh, yeah, we do. After going through Hurricane Harvey, you know what? That scratches the surface. I mean, just peels the outer layer of skin off of that. It scratches the surface of what it means for it to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Let me give you a little bit of statistics here, okay? This is from the National Weather Service, so you know it's good, okay? According to the National Weather Service in Southeast Texas, 26 inches of rain fell on Port Arthur in 24 hours during Hurricane Harvey. At that point, it's not a hurricane, it's a tropical storm. 26 inches of rain fell on Port Arthur in a matter of 24 hours. That's not even the most astounding fact. Here in our home in Nederland, the people in here whose homes are still recovering, our building's still recovering from this. Here in Nederland, we received 60.58 inches of rain from August 24th to September 1st. 60.58 inches of rain. 5 feet. 5 feet of rain from August 24th to September 1st. Here's some more staggering statistics here. In Southeast Texas, there was 3,643 square miles that were covered in rainfall that was greater than 40 inches. 3,600 square miles with water that fell greater than 40 inches. Listen to this. There was 11,492 square miles that was covered in more than 30 inches. So 11,500 square miles. There were 28,949 square miles of Southeast Texas that was covered in 20 inches of rainfall. Almost 29,000 square miles. You know how big that is? That's bigger than the state of West Virginia. September 24th, or August 24th, September 1st. 60.58 inches of rain fell on the top of this roof here. And some people got 8 feet of water in their homes, depending on where they were with sea level. Some people got 3 inches. Some people, their homes just utterly, utterly destroyed. That was for a few days of rain. God told Noah it's going to rain for 40 days, a month and 10 days. It will rain straight, just like that. Not only that, it gets even worse than that. Look at verse 6. More precise language. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him went into the ark to escape. Where does Noah go for escape? He goes into God's design for his escape. He and his family, they went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. And doesn't verse 7 kind of read in the sense that God says, 7 days, it's going to flood. All these animals, you get them. They're coming to you. You get them in the ark. And verse 7 kind of reads like they're hurrying here. They run into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Verse 8, of clean animals and of animals that are not clean and of birds and of everything that creeps on the ground. Two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah as God had commanded Noah. There it is again. As God had commanded Noah, even the animals. The animals that are saved are obeying God's command. Noah is obeying God's command to get the animals in, and they're all hurrying. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. Just as the Lord said, after 7 days, the rain starts. Now look at verses 11 through 24. What you see is the faithfulness of God in the fulfillment of his promises. Now that's understanding that twofold, the faithfulness of God in the fulfillment of his promises. So God makes promises to the wicked and the righteous, doesn't he? He does. He makes promises that he will save the righteous, those who place their faith in him, not just good deed doers. The righteous are those who trust in God. But he's also going to destroy the wicked. You see that in the end, God doesn't back away from that promise of judgment, nor does he renege on that promise of rescue. God is faithful in the fulfillment of his promises to all people. He's no respecter of person. He is a keeper of his promises. Look at verses 11 through 24 right here. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened. You know, I kind of got a little bit of a picture. Brother Jim, myself, and I believe it was Brother Eric, may have even been Brother Clint. We were in the foyer that Sunday morning when the church flooded, and we were considering whether or not to have service. And we're hearing all these forecasts online that Harvey's coming, the rain's coming, it's going to be bad, and city officials had already started putting out roadblocks, but we found our way to church, and we thought, hey, we're going to have church, because it really hadn't started raining that much. And then we were standing there in the foyer right in front of the preschool, and we're sitting there debating, should we have church? And Brother Eric's like, I don't think we should. I think the rain's coming. We need to listen to the forecast. And I'm like, well, I'm ready to preach. We're ready to have church. Let's do this. We were able to get here, so maybe we're going to be okay here. As we were standing there, I'll never forget that, Brother Eric. As we were standing there, it was like the windows of heaven opened up. And there was water that we were looking out those glass windows. And the water, Brother Jim, it came down so hard. It was like somebody had taken a solid sheet and just rolled it down in front of the awning. You couldn't see your vehicle. You couldn't see a blade of grass. There was so much water that fell in a moment. We went from having pretty much dry ground outside, and in 15 minutes, we had 3 inches of water in the offices. The windows of heaven opening up. Again, that's just scratching the surface. Because look at Noah. In Noah's day, they didn't just get the windows of heaven that opened up. They got it from above and from below. It says in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, verse 11, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep. So there was a shifting of the tectonic plates where they opened up, and those wells underneath those plates just burst forth and started filling up. And the work that God had done in creating the world, do you remember when God made the land to rise up and to separate the waters from the waters, and he called it dry land, and he makes the plants to grow up? What does God do here? It's almost anti-creation. He takes that same land that separates the waters, and he moves it, and the deep just bursts forth, and the water's coming from above and from below. Verse 12, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights, just as God said, that is. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. There it is. We're going to repeat that. Where do they go for salvation? Where do they go for safety? They go to God's design. They go to God's provision for safety. They enter the ark. Verse 14, they and every beast according to its kind, and all the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and to every bird according to its kind, and every winged creature. Verse 15, here it is again. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in, here it is, as God had commanded him. As God had commanded who? As God commanded Noah. Noah obeyed, the animals are saved. Noah obeyed, his children are saved. Noah obeyed, their wives are saved. Noah obeyed, Noah is saved. Saved through faithful obedience is the point here. And they went in as God had commanded him. And look at this. And the Lord shut him in. You remember Noah built a big door on the front? Noah didn't shut that. You imagine that? What a sign. Before the rain even starts, they get the last animal, just scurries up the ramp there, gets into the boat, and the Lord's hands lift up that door and shut it. Not only shut it, but the Lord shut him in. You imagine the look on Noah and his family's faces as they're sitting there in this giant box filled with animals, and that door starts moving on its own, and the Lord shut him in. Now, why did the Lord shut him in? Why didn't Noah make some way? The Lord didn't tell him to make a way to shut the door. The Lord was going to do it. That's the Lord's boat. He just commissioned Noah to build it. But that's the Lord's boat in the end. That is God's provision for salvation. Continue looking here, verse 17. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark. And it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. That's about 22 foot deep. That's covering the top of the highest mountain. And all flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He, that is God, blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground. Man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those who were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Just a few things I want to show you here from that passage, verses 11 through 24. Like I told you just a moment ago, when it says, and Noah did all that God commanded, and Noah did as God commanded, four times here. Look back at 6:22. It says Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. It says it again in 7:5, 7:9, and 7:16. Noah did all that God commanded him. What is the Lord trying to point to our emphasis here? Noah is saved through faithful obedience. That's the point that you just sit there and repeat it over and over and over again. Now, this is interesting. Because again, God has made promise. He's made a promise to save Noah through faithful obedience, and he's made a promise, and he's repeated it about six times, that he is going to blot out all life on the earth. And he's going to do that through a flood. Now, look at it is absolutely deliberate. Look at the deliberate contrast between what happens with the water, between Noah and his family and all other creatures. Look at the difference here. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The water increased, and it bore up the ark. So when the waters come, the waters of God's judgment come, they lift Noah above the filth. They lift Noah and his family above the unrighteousness, above the ungodliness, above the celebration of godlessness. It lifts Noah and his family up. Look at what else it says. The waters prevail, verse 18, and increase greatly on the earth, and the ark floated. And the ark floated. So God's judgment comes, and they're actually lifted up higher in the judgment. They're elevated here in the judgment. Their righteousness is proven in the last blink of every eye as they sunk down under the deep. You know what they saw? They saw the ark. They saw Noah and his family being raised up, being elevated, not because of their works, but because of their faith in God. But look at what happens to those who do not have their faith in God. Verse 20. The waters prevailed above the mountains. 15 cubits. The waters prevailed above the mountains. So the ark floats. The mountains sink. The ark floats, and then you have here all flesh that moved on earth. It all dies. So the mountains sink, the ark floats. The flesh dies, the ark floats. The breath of life, it's going to say, leaves all mankind that was left. It leaves all the creatures that were left. But the ark floats, and Noah lives. See the contrast here? One of the things that people on the earth in those days trusted in. You remember what it said in Genesis 6? You have the celebration of the worldly celebration, that is, of the Nephilim. And they're the mighty warriors on the earth. They're the ones who are professional killers. They are the warlords, and they're the mighty men, the men of renown. What do they trust in? Some trust in chariots. Some in horses. They trust in their abilities. They trust in their abilities to rule over man. What did they forget about? Man will never rule over God. So you got to be in right relationship with him. And you have the parents of the Nephilim, the sons of God. And their lust rules over them. And they're governed. They put their hope in what their body is going to feel. They put their hope in everything that is lustful and sensual and immoral. And they're celebrated. And their children are celebrated. But who does Noah put his faith in? God. If there was a person on earth that says, you know what, Noah, I hear you talking about a flood coming. This whole time you've been building a boat. Well, you know what, I don't believe in God, but just to be cautious, I'm going to go build my house on the highest mountain. And this man may put his faith in the mountaintops, and he's 22 foot under the water. He's a dead man. You're going to have people saying, well, I haven't died yet. God hasn't struck me down. I'm going to put my trust in the fact that I'm alive. God hasn't seemed to disagree with my lifestyle up to this point. I'll put my trust in my flesh. All flesh sunk. Every bit of breath of life was suffocated as it drowned under the waters of God's judgment. But where's Noah? Up there. Noah's floating. Noah is high above those waters of judgment. Indeed, Psalm 25:3, indeed, None who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Write down this second truth with me here. Those who place their hope in the Lord will not be put to shame. Those who put their hope in the Lord, their faith in the Lord, will not be put to shame. It says this in Proverbs 18:10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous man runs into it and is safe. Does your boat float? The object of your faith? You know, this is the truth about faith. All creatures are faithful. The question is, who or what are they faithful to? Who or what do they place their faith in? Everybody is faithful. Everybody trusts in something. Some people trust in the idea that they can save up a lot of money and they can fight off cancer and they can have a good life and survive to the end. And they put their faith in hope. They actually put their faith in hope that when they die, things are going to turn out. There's some people that put their faith in morality. They put their faith in the fact that, well, because they don't get drunk too much, and because they don't cheat on their wife, and because they pay their bills and make sure their kids have a roof over their head and clothes on their backs, that God must be a respecter of that. What is that person putting their hope in? What's their vote? Their boat is their effort. Their boat is in doing enough stuff that it makes God okay with them, and doing enough good things that it outweighs the fact that they cuss a little, or they watch a little bit of pornography, or they cheat on their taxes some. That what's their hope in? Their hope and their boat is in the fact that they think that they do enough to outweigh it. As people of God, our hope is not in the things that we do. As people of God, our hope is in the fact that Jesus did all the good things for us. Our hope is in the fact that Jesus died on our behalf, that Jesus went through the waters of God's judgment for us. And he paid the price. That's what we're going to talk about on Sunday. Jesus is the propitiation for our sins. He's the satisfaction for our sins. Our hope is in that, that we are from this wicked generation. But we turn to Jesus, and he washes our wickedness away, and he brings us into the light. That's our hope. We place our faith in Jesus and his righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, the Apostle Paul says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to be arrogant and boastful, that is, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Listen to what it says in Titus chapter 2, verse 11 through 14. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us, be like Noah, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age, waiting for our boat, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works. God has prepared an ark for the faithful. And that ark is not a boat. That ark is a person. That ark is the Lord Jesus. He has prepared that boat for anyone who would hear that call and believe in Christ and enter into God's provision to escape judgment. Yes, God has promised he will not destroy the earth again with water, but he has not promised that he will not destroy the earth. The Bible tells us very clearly, I could give you a running list of passages right now if time permitted, but God has promised us very clearly that he will destroy this earth, not with water, but with fire. And the ark that we enter into, the boat that floats in the judgment of God, is Jesus. You see, faith is a good thing, But the quality of your faith is only as good as the object in which you have put it. Faith is a good thing, but faith is only as good as the object in which you put it. So if you put your faith in your money, it's not going to last you. Paul calls that the uncertainty of riches. Same thing he talks about with fleeting pleasures of this life. Those are boats that don't float. Those are boats that'll carry you along for a little bit, but as soon as you get out in the middle of the Natchez, they have a hole in them. And you suddenly realize that they're not going to save you. They're not going. That's what every person on their deathbed without God, that's what they begin to realize. That the money they hoped in, the job, the career, the family, all those things, it didn't save them from death. Jesus is our boat. Truth number three, final truth here, God will faithfully fulfill his promise to destroy the wicked and save those who are faithfully committed to him. God will faithfully fulfill his promise to destroy the wicked and save those who are faithfully committed to him. This text, if anything, teaches us a number of truths about the faithful obedience of Noah and how he saved by putting his hope in God's provision for his salvation. And it also teaches us that God is sovereign to save the faithful, and God is sovereign to destroy the wicked. Think of all the terms of precision here. Noah is 600 years old when he enters the ark. God says it's going to rain in 7 days. The rain starts in 7 days. It's going to rain 40 days and 40 nights, and it rains 40 days and 40 nights. The water's going to be there 150 days, and it is so. The animals are going to come to Noah, and they do, just as God commands. And God commands Noah, and Noah does what God says. God is sovereign over all things. And as Christians, we celebrate the promises of God that God has made to people who've placed their faith in Jesus. We also have to remember the opposite end of that. Yes, God will be faithful to fulfill his promises to us. He'll never leave us, nor will he forsake us. He will raise us up on the last day. We don't grieve as those who have no hope. Death, where is your sting? And all those, and so on and so forth. He'll give us peace that surpasses all understanding when we cast our cares on him. We don't have to be anxious for anything. These are wonderful promises. But what else has God promised? He's promised us that it is appointed for man once to die, and after that, the judgment. In that day, will your boat float? Because God is gracious to save the faithful, we must be obedient to all God commands. Would you pray with me?